last quote from the central review. Right, so what I'm going to speak on today is called the Ricci Flow Program in math. And the motivation for that is to address the Thurston Convergence. So I'm going to give a heuristic idea of what the Thurston conjecture is. So the motivation for the Thurston conjecture is something well known to mathematicians in the 19th century, and that's called the uniformization theorem. So what the uniformization theorem says is that you take any closed connected surface, Riemann surface, and so it could have one hole or it could have many holes, and each of these surfaces admits a metric of constant curvature. So this one, for example, admits a spherical metric, and this one admits a flat metric, and every one of these others admits hyperbolic. So in particular, you can get each of these surfaces by means of discrete identifications of the spherical metric or the flat or hyperbolic. So this is the statement of the uniformization theorem, and it's pretty old. So the question is, what about 3D? The statement of the theorem is basically that every connected closed two-manifold admits a metric of constant curvature. So what the statement is basically a statement about the existence of nice metrics on these closed two-manifolds. And there are three nice metrics which are the constant curvature. So one can ask, what about 3D? Are there such nice metrics in 3D? And the 3D statement is Thurston's conjecture. But 3D is complicated, because suppose we ask, can we say every three manifold admits R3, S3, or H3? Obviously not, because you can have, for example, H2 cross S1. So what is the analogous statement in 3D? And Thurston's idea was to think of this 2D result in a different way. So basically, you can think of this 2D result as, let X be compact, be a compact surface, then X admits a locally homogeneous metric, which is locally isometric actually to the constant curvature surface. So the question that you can ask is, what are the locally homogeneous metrics in 3D? Maybe those are the nice metrics in 3D. So a homogeneous space, recall, is a space where you can go from any point to any other point by means of an action of a Legal. And a locally homogeneous space is something which is obtained from discrete identifications of a homogeneous space. So the idea is, if you think about this statement as being a statement on locally homogeneous metrics being the nice metrics, then you can ask if the locally homogeneous metrics in 3D are the nice metrics. Okay? So there are 8 of these 3D metrics or geometries, which are, of course, R3, S3, S3, S2 cross S1, H2 cross S1, and 3 others, which I'm not going to describe here. It'll take me a long time to describe. Basically, those are the 8 locally homogeneous metrics. So 8 nice metrics. So the question is, are these the 8 nice metrics? So if I take any closed connected 3 manifold, will it admit one of these 8 nice metrics? Now the answer is that this is not enough. There are known 3 manifolds. That do not admit any of these metrics. So Thurston's idea of Thurston's conjecture is that you do take any 3 manifold. And there exists a canonical decomposition of this 3 manifold. That is, you break up this 3 manifold into pieces in a certain unique way. There's a way of doing that. Once you break up the 3 manifold into pieces, then Thurston's conjecture is that each piece admits one of these 8 nice metrics. So what is this canonical decomposition? So what you do is you have some 3 manifold, which I'm just drawing here. Okay. Now this 3 manifold could have special spheres in toroid, which are incompressible, which means that they're not filled in. So it could have a sphere, 2 sphere, or it could have a 2 torus that is incompressible. So Thurston's statement is, remove these spheres and remove these tori from your manifold, it breaks up into pieces, and each piece admits one of those statements. So what you want to do is you want to break that up by removing So if you've seen the connected sum of manifolds, how you perform a connected sum, this is the opposite of a connected sum. For example, removing those incompressible spheres is the opposite of doing the connected, it's the sort of inverse of doing the connected sum.
Well, what is an incompressible sphere?
It's something which is not filled in. Okay, it's not the boundary of a 3 ball. And an incompressible torus is not the boundary of a solid torus. So if you remove all that and then you have all these pieces, then Thurston's conjecture is each piece admits one of the locally homogeneous. Metrics.
But those metrics are not such that they piece together again.
Well, you can piece them together back by putting in those spheres into right.
But do those metrics fit together then?
That's not important because those metrics obviously do not fit together, right? Because the statement is that if you take the whole 3 manifold, you can find 3 manifolds where you can't put one of these geometries. So the thing is that each piece could admit a different one out of those spaces.
Yeah, but then there are those gluing interfaces, right? Which is right. Like 2 torus or 2 sphere. And
well, you can
then you get 2 metrics on the same 2 sphere which are not compatible. Right?
I think there's a way of gluing them in such a way that you can produce a compatibility. But the thing is that you cannot put just one nice metric.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah. But the question is whether you can still glue it together. You have like 10 different pieces with all different metrics.
Right.
Don't talk to each
other. You can glue them back together because there's a way of performing the inverse operation. The inverse operation removing that 2 sphere is just performing a connected sum, which gives you more function.
I mean, glue together such metrics and 2 spheres.
Sure. Actually, No, I think that's not important, because what you're only making a statement about is about each piece.
Yeah,
you don't care if they can be viewed here.
Okay, no, that's what I wanted to know, whether you really only talk about each piece.
Yes, I think we really only talk about each piece, but I'm pretty sure that you can put back a two scale. I'm not sure about the two torus.
It's a question, right. It's a question of patches, right? You can't, you have to do the little patches, so you glue it back. If you want to put the sphere back, it's a little piece of homogeneous kind of a little piece of the sphere. You probably need many different coordinate patches, so the metrics are not going to be.
Yeah, but wherever you took a two sphere out, right?
I think you can put the two sphere back, and you can smoothly continue the metrics. But I'm not sure about the two torus, and it doesn't matter for the data. It just talks about the case. Okay, so there's a subconjecture that is every four simply connected three manifolds. And the subconjecture says that simply connected three manifolds admit S3 metrics. And this subconjecture is much older than Thurston conjecture. It's called the Funker. So these are the questions. I mean, are those conjectures true? These are the questions that the Ricci flow program wants to address. So the question is, what is the Ricci flow program, and how does it propose to address these questions? So the idea is to start with a PDE, okay?
Sorry, yes. Is there any way of seeing that one follows from the other?
Yeah, sure. There's a way of seeing that. I mean, the subconjecture of Poincaré is a part of the Thurston conjecture.
It's a part of it.
Yeah. There's a way of seeing that. I don't remember the complete argument. It's not obvious, right, the way I stated it. Yeah, but it is a sub.
Okay, so if you prove the first
conjecture,
yes,
you have proved. Yes. Okay. So the question is, what is this approach of the Ricci flow? The idea is to start with a PDE that looks like this. Okay, I'll come later to why this PDE was chosen. But once you have a PDE like that, you have a flow of metrics on a manifold N. So take a three manifold N, and at some t equal to zero, at some initial time, start with any smooth metric you can think of. So say G at t equal to zero is some G zero. Now, is there a way by which you can start this flow, and you can integrate this equation, and you can get that this G flows to one of those nice metrics? Okay, that's the idea. It's a naive idea as the way I put it, but let's see where it takes us. So does G flow to a nice metric? Why was this PDE chosen? You could have put anything else on the right-hand side. You could have taken something which had two derivatives in time. The idea is that this looks very much like a heat equation. And just as you know that heat equation does something nice to a function, the hope is that this could do something nice as well. Okay, and you want to take something which is one derivative in time, and on the right-hand side, you can take anything you like, but if you take something simpler, then you already know that it doesn't lead to anything interesting. So the simplest thing, which is complex enough, seems to be the Ricci flow. And why is there a negative sign here? Well, if you have a flow of the metric which looks like that, then you can work out what is the flow of the scalar curvature. And the flow of the scalar curvature then turns out to be so the flow of the scalar curvature looks like a heat equation with the right sign. That's very important. If you have a negative sign here, you have a positive sign here. And it's important to have a heat equation with the right sign, because if you have a backward heat equation, it does not have long time solutions. Solutions will blow up if you put the wrong sign in the heat equation. So that's why you need this equation. And still the idea looks very nice. So why is there a hope that this idea works?
Sorry, but there you're starting with a three manifold that contains the S2 and the P2 that are incompressible.
Yes. So you have to implement the decomposition somehow.
Right.
The flow has to implement.
Oh, the flow.
That's one of the problems.
Okay.
I'm going to come to that. But why do we believe, why do we even want to work with that flow? Why do we believe it will work? The idea is that in 2D, it works. But of course, you might say 2D is simple, there's no decomposition to be done, and also we already know, we already have a different proof for 2D. However, it's nice that it works. So how does it work in 2D? Well, if I start with any simply connected surface, okay, that surface under the Ricci flow gets rounder until it becomes the complete round sphere. But this round sphere is not a fixed point of the Ricci flow, so it's going to flow further, it's going to shrink to a point. So the thing is, the fact that it's not a fixed point of the Ricci flow does not bother us, because at some point in between, we already had a round sphere metric, so we know that the simply connected surface admits a round sphere metric. Yeah.
Is that after finite time of flow that the metric is really
After a finite time of the flow, in fact, the whole space disappears. It's all happening in finite time.
Yeah, but before it disappears, that
yeah.
gets round
yes.
after finite
yes.
time, then only shrinks?
Yes, you can prove that.
What does that mean? It gets approximately round, right?
It gets to be the perfect round sphere, you can show that, and then the round sphere itself shrinks under the flow. So you get the round sphere metric before it actually disappears. So, and of course you can do that for something with higher genus. And the property is that if you start with something which has negative curvature, that tends to expand, but then it does flow to space of constant H2.
Excuse me, I don't believe that.
You don't believe that it goes into the round sphere?
Yeah, because, I mean, in principle, oh, maybe I'm wrong here, but sorry, but what it looks to me is that you just could invert the sign in this differential, partial differential equation, then you could run the whole thing backwards. But if at some point you end up at a perfect sphere, your object, your manifold, has lost any information of the initial state. So in fact, you couldn't go backwards.
Now let me think about whether you can see. There's a problem with just putting this minus sign out here, right? There's a problem with doing that, because as far as this PDE is concerned, you will not get solutions for a long time. So I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, anyway, you could.
Yeah, you mean integrate this in backward time.
Yeah, go back.
Yeah, if you want to integrate this in backward time, then you have to start with an initial condition at backward time.
But if you start with an initial condition which is a round sphere, the sphere is always going to stay round. It's never going to be the thing that you originally started.
Let me think about that. Well, actually, it works, but I have to think a bit more about that, because it's a question of whether you... So you're solving this equation in backward time. You start with an initial condition in backward time, and then you can integrate that. And I'm not sure that you'll get the same as the three manifold you started out with, but...
Anyway,
yeah, think about
it.
Yeah, no, that I definitely believe.
Yeah.
Question for after finite time.
After finite time.
Yeah. But actually, you can define an entropy along these kinds of flows. So it appears that there is a loss of information. You can define an entropy which monotonically increases along this flow. So it appears that there is a loss of information. But I'll think about it. I'll think about how you integrate the equation in backward time. Okay, so what happens is that in 2D, this thing seems to work, right? You start with any simply connected surface, it goes to a two-sphere. If you start with anything with higher holes, then it flows to the constant curvature. And the fact that a two-sphere or a hyperbolic metric is not a fixed point of this flow does not matter, because you can actually add a term to this flow. You can add some term here, okay, which basically is such that volume is preserved. So you can add a term which works in such a way that the volume is preserved, and then it will turn out that two-sphere or hyperbolic metric are fixed points of that particular. So that's not a problem. But the question is really how to do this for 3D. Yes.
Can I go back to this problem for a moment?
Yeah.
So if you have a, let's say the spherical metric, a two-sphere metric, right? Then Rij is proportional to Gij.
That's right.
But then I see that this doesn't shrink to a point in the time. I can see that too fast.
I'm sorry?
Because if you have d by dt of Gij,
right,
it's minus 2 times Gij.
It depends where you put the parameter t. So you could, in your round sphere, R, the radius of function of t, that's going to shrink.
Yeah. In fact, you just look at the scalar curvature equation. And you just take the scalar curvature to be some constant, where the constant depends on t, right? 1 over a of t squared. You'll see that it shrinks. So, I mean, that's very easy to work. Okay, so in 3D, what are the difficulties? So the question is, how do you implement the canonical decomposition when you just have this flow? So the flow was originally introduced by Hamilton, who suggested the idea of Ricci flow with surgeon.
Sorry. Could it be that the second term you have in the RG flow equation that has a modulus square acts as a friction term that makes the flow irreversible?
You mean this term? Actually, I think even this thing would make the flow irreversible, because
a friction term would explain the fact that you go to the sphere and you lose the memory of the point where you start.
That's right, but can you not define an entropy even for the heat equation?
The point is that if you flow the equation forward in time,
that's
you
right.
will end up with a very particular initial configuration.
That's right, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
But so if you have a friction term, you discover it.
That's right, so if you start that equation from a two-sphere, for example, and then you cannot go back and get information about Rij flow.
Right, and I mean, basically, he was trying to prove that it was impossible to reach a round sphere.
Right.
If you have a reversible flow.
Right.
But if you have something that has a friction term, then you lose information.
Right.
Actually, even without that term in the first equation, right after the example, Rij for a surface metric by putting in an arbitrary function of R and T, then if you expand out RIJ, actually already has a friction term if you compare with the traditional diffusion.
So that's the reason you have exemption term and then you lose information. It's obviously grounds, if there are sphere.
The question is, do you adapt the individual information, say exponentially in time, or do you lose it completely?
Well, for that, we would have to study the equation.
Yeah. I would be very interested.
Okay, so in 3D, the question is how do you implement this canonical decomposition? And the idea was perhaps you can do surgery somewhere in between, and then you can try to continue the Ricci flow after surgery. But then the question is that the surgery has to exactly remove the pieces which are allowed in the decomposition, which are maybe the incompressible spheres and plural. You're also allowed to remove three walls, which cost nothing, but you cannot remove anything apart from these three pieces. Those these are.
Can I just ask one other question? It's bothered me about the original equation, which is that if I actually pick some metric and write this down, and if I have a sufficiently messy three manifold, then I can write out the initial GIG on some patch.
Right.
So I'm only flowing on a patch.
Right.
So do I need to worry that I'm not really worrying about the full global property?
Okay, so this is actually, I forgot to mention that this is a flow through geometries. So this is a flow of the metric mod diffeomorphisms. So you're really talking about curvature flows. I mean, all the results which people have done in Ricci flow start with curvature flows, actually. So although we start with this metric and then we define a flow for the metric, it's just to get the flow for curvature. Okay, so the surgery has to remove only these pieces, and that's the trouble with doing Ricci flow surgery. And what are the problems with this program if you want to do it in three dimensions? So the first problem which is the most basic problem has to do with the monotonicity of the Ricci flow. Why is this a problem? It's because if this Ricci flow has periodic solutions, okay, so you start at some geometry and then you flow somewhere and then you come back to the same geometry and then you keep doing this forever, then you're not reaching anywhere. So you will not have a situation where this metric is actually flowing to a nice metric, or you're flowing to a nice geometry. You're just oscillating. Okay. So periodic solutions are a problem. This is periodic solution in geometry. So what you want is that you don't want a solution where g of t is related to some g of 0 by diffeomorphs. You don't want such solutions. Because if you have them, then you might not reach anywhere. So you don't want this unless all along the way from 0 to t, the metric changes only by h. Unless all along 0 to t, geometry does not change. That's okay because then you're at a fixed point of geometry, but you don't want these kind of periodic solutions. In fact, you don't even want solutions that change by a scaling and a diffeomorph. So don't even want g of t is equal to some alpha times phi t star g of 0, where alpha is some scaling parameter. Don't even want that because you can have some geometry that looks like that. Okay, under the flow, it could just shrink but look like the same and could never flow to a nice metric. So in order to rule out these periodic solutions.
Sorry, but then you're saying that you allow fixed points. So
yeah.
It's a claim that the fixed point will be the nice metric that you're looking for.
One of the fixed points obviously is the Ricci flat metric. And yeah, it's a nice metric. Okay, because if let's see. Yeah, I'll come to that. Anyway, I'm coming to that. Okay, so you don't want all these things, and you don't mind fixed points, but you, as soon as the flow starts, as soon as the metric starts flowing, you don't want these kind of solutions. So in order to rule these solutions out, the strategy is to find an entropy. So by entropy, I only mean something which changes monotonically and shows you that the flow is irreversible. I don't mean anything more than that. I don't mean something which looks like trace, roll, or row or something like that. Okay. So this was done only recently by Perelman in 2002. So until then, people really had problems with this Ricci flow program. And almost all the major problems were resolved by him in 2002. So what kind of entropy do you need? Well, you need an entropy that only characterizes geometry. And is monotonic along the flow, constant only at fixed points geometry. So if I have time, I will describe the proof of that statement. I'm not going to prove every statement I say here, but I'm going to describe proof of that. So the statement, the claim is that Perelman has actually done that. He's found such an entropy. And he's also found another related scale invariant entropy. So together, both these entropies actually rule out solutions like that. And solutions like that. Okay, because the entropy depends only on geometry. And it's monotonic, but here if I have to have a solution like that, the entropy at t equal to 0 should be the same as entropy at small t, but then all along in between it's increased. That cannot be true. So this rules out such periodic solutions. Okay, that was problem number one. What is the other serious problem? Problem number two is the possible singular behavior under this flow. So this is a nonlinear PDE, right? So it could do anything horrible to this geometry. So how do you know what's the singular behavior under this flow? So what are all types of singular behavior possible? We already saw that if you have a two-sphere or any round sphere, that thing is going to shrink to a point. The other kind of behavior that people study for three manifolds is that you can have these necks, and then these necks just shrink and pinch off. But then you could have something which is worse. Okay, so I'm just going to draw all the possibilities. And then we're going to see which ones are allowed and which ones are not allowed if this Ricci flow program is to address Thurston's condition. So you're talking about a singularity in the curvature, so what are all the other kinds of horrible behavior that can happen? Well, you can have something goes singular at a point or at a finite set of points, like that. Okay. Or you could have these necks. I just drew how those necks can pinch off, but then the question is, what is the cross-section of a neck? This question is very important for the Ricci flow. The cross-section of a neck here could be a two-sphere, okay, and then it pinches off, so it just gets smaller and smaller. Or the cross-section of a neck could be something which has lower dimension as it gets narrower than a two-sphere. Okay, so it could be, for example, an S1 cross an interval. And we could also have a neck that's approximately flat, or something which just goes into a one-dimensional manner. You can have all these possible kinds of singularity. Now, if this Ricci flow program is to really address Thurston's conjecture, then the only kind of singular behavior that's allowed is one that helps us to implement the decomposition. Okay? So the decomposition says you can throw away incompressible spheres, you can throw away incompressible tori, so that's the only kind of thing that is allowed to pinch off. You're not allowed to have any other kind of singularity. Otherwise, this program is no use. And until 2002, people were not sure about that. So it's only because of Perelman's work that we know something more about it. So what is the strategy to find out what kinds of singular behavior out of these possibilities are shown by Ricci flow? So I'll focus on one of them, which is the neck pinch. You want to ask, I have this neck pinch which is possible under Ricci flow. I want to ask, what is the cross-section of that neck pinch? Is the cross-section a two-sphere, or is the cross-section something different, like, for example, S1 cross I? Why do I want to know that? Because typically these necks are going to pinch off, so I'm going to lose either this two-sphere or this S1 cross I. I'm not allowed to lose an S1 cross I. If I want to implement the canonical decomposition, I'm only allowed to lose this two-sphere. Okay, so it's very important to know what's the cross-section. So how do we find out what is the cross-section? So this is the machinery which one has to develop, which is I have a neck. I want to focus on a point in that neck. Okay? And I want to see that point as the neck is getting smaller and smaller. So what I need is to find the topology and the metric near the neck. I need a notion of convergence that allows me to focus on special points in a manifold rather than on the whole manifold. So what is that notion of convergence? There exists one which is suited for that. That's called a smooth pointed Cheever-Gromov convergence. And this convergence is a convergence which is true manifolds with metrics and special points. Okay, so Pi is a point in Mi. So you take a sequence of such manifolds with some metrics and with some special points, and there's a notion of convergence by which they go over to an M, G. And these are smooth and complete. And so you go over to some MGP and you start with these compact sequence of compact manifolds. The limit need not be compact. That's not a problem. So if you want to apply, first of all, there are some conditions which you have to fulfill in order to have this convergence. But we'll get to the conditions later. But even if you want to apply this notion of convergence, you need to know how to pick your points. Okay, so the most important thing here is point picking. How do you pick the points to get the convergence that you want, which is you want to zero in on the neck. So, for example, if you pick the points badly, then you might never end up on the neck. So if you start with something that looks like that, if you pick a point here, then under this Cheeger-Gromov convergence, you're going to converge to something which looks like that. But if you pick your point here, then the hope is that you converge to something which looks like that. Now, I don't know that that's a two-sphere error, I've just found that. So what are the conditions for this Cheeger-Gromov convergence? So the two conditions, one is bounds on curvature. And you don't need a bound on curvature throughout the whole three-manifold because you're not looking at the whole three-manifold. Mm-hmm. You're only looking at the region around the point P. So you need bounds on curvature in metric balls around. And second thing is, you need something which is known as the injectivity radius, which I'll come to later, of this manifold at Ti has a lower bound. So if I can satisfy both these conditions, which I'll discuss now, then you can apply this Cheeger-Gromov convergence. You can zero in on some point in the net, and then you can keep taking the sequence of points, and you can say, what is the limiting metric or topology of the net? And that will tell you if that net has a cross-section which is a sphere or a cross-section which is something different. That's the idea. Okay, so how do you have a bound on curvature in metric balls around this point P? When the neck is forming, that's precisely what is not happening because the neck is very small, so the curvature could be very large. So how do you bound the curvature? Okay, the way you bound the curvature is by a standard technique known as a parabolic free scale. What's the idea behind the parabolic free scale? It's really very simple. What you do is, suppose you have a family of metrics which you know solve the Ricci flow, go to a new metric d hat xt, which is obtained from the old metric by such a scaling by a parameter lambda. So the metric is also scaled by a factor lambda, and t is scaled by inverse of lambda. Then what happens? And define this for t, which is from 0 to lambda capital T. G of t is defined from for t from 0 to capital T. Okay. Now, what happens when you do this? Well, something very nice happens. You can ask what is the flow of g hat, because g hat is related to g, and you have a flow equation for g. So what is the flow equation for g hat? The flow equation for g hat is just flow of g with respect to this t by lambda. Okay, and this thing we know from Ricci flow is just minus rij of g of t by lambda. Okay, but the Ricci tensor is scale invariant. So this is the same as minus rij of t hat. I just used the Ricci tensor as scale invariant. So what I get is that if I do this kind of a scaling, then g hat is also a solution to Ricci flow. So I get that g hat is a solution to Ricci flow. It is basically related to the old solution G by just inflating the old solution and looking at a fast time. So the Ricci tensor is scale invariant, but the scalar curvature is not scale invariant. So the scalar curvature of T hat is just lambda inverse of so the scalar curvature actually decreases by this factor lambda. So what we've done is that we've gone from solutions G to solutions G hat, which retain almost all information about the old solutions, except that they look blown up and the scalar curvature is decreased. So this is a way by which you can control the curve. So the idea is now to take lambda to be the curvature itself, to be the maximum curvature itself, so what you want to do is that, suppose you have these nets and you have some points pi, p1, p2, p3, okay? At each point, you take whichever point has the maximum of the scalar curvature, you take that and you rescale the solution by that. So you will get a whole sequence of solutions which always have curvature of the order 1. Okay? So you will always get mi, gi, pi. Now you know how to pick your points p because you pick those points where the curvature is maximum and then you rescale. And this sequence of manifolds has curvature of the order of order 1. So the idea behind doing this exercise was to apply this notion of Cheeger-Romov convergence. And there was a second condition there. So the first condition is something we fulfilled, which is we managed to bound curvature. The second condition is something to do with the injectivity rates, which I will just give you an idea of what it is. So the injectivity radius injectivity radius at a point P in M for a closed manifold is half the length of a minimal closed geodesic that starts at the point P and ends back at the point P. So you take all the possible closed geodesics through the point P, and you take the smallest one, and you take half of that, that's the injectivity radius. Or if the manifold has conjugate points, like here to here, it's a distance from this point P to its conjugate point. And that is the injectivity radius. So the thing is that what you require for this result is that the injectivity radius is the lower bound. And the injectivity radius is related, so the lower bound on injectivity radius implies and is implied by a lower bound on volumes of balls centered at P divided by this factor. So I have to explain what this factor is. Well, let's forget about the injectivity radius because the lower bound on that quantity called the injectivity radius is related to a lower bound of this quantity. What is this quantity? This quantity says you take these geodesic balls which are around P, okay, of some radius R. So I should call this the same R. Divide that by R power, the dimension of the manifold of your space. If it's three dimensions, it's just R cubed. Now this is the volume of balls in flat space. Of balls in flat n-dimensional space. So you're dividing the volume of balls in your manifold with respect to your metric by the volume of balls in flat n-dimensional space. Now this ratio, if this ratio has a lower bound, By a low bound, I mean a low bound epsilon which is greater than 0. So if it has a positive lower bound, then this injectivity radius also has a positive lower bound. And then we are done. Now, what is the meaning of this? Now, if this ratio has goes to 0, that means that we are really having a metric which is not n-dimensional. It's one dimension less. Okay, so this is precisely what we need to rule out the cross section which are not like two spheres but which are like one dimension less. Okay. So how do you do this? Well, this is another result of Perelman. This is known as the no collapsing theorem. I'm just going to give you the heuristic statement. If I have Perelman's statement heuristically says that if curvature is bounded above we get a lower bound on the volume ratio. So all I need to do is to bound the curvature in balls around some point P, and that automatically from Perelman's results tells me that this thing has a lower bound which is non-zero. So this implies that volume of balls with respect to the metric G divided by Rn is less than, or sorry, is greater than epsilon, which is greater than zero. Okay, so this rules out the fact that if you have a cross section of a net, which is, so this tells you that the cross section of the net should be a two sphere and not be one, a manifold of one dimension low, like S1 cross I, which when it shrinks, is going to behave like a manifold of one dimension low. So this tells you that cross section of a net is an S2. Okay, now the rest of it is really easy to do because what you're going to do is do surgery. So the next step is to remove that two sphere. Yes?
So I just wanted to ask, what are the assumptions going into this theorem?
The assumptions going into this no collapsing theorem. That is just saying that this thing is less than 1 over R. Oh, sorry, let me call this V naught. This is less than the radius, 1 over the radius, where the R is the radius of this metric ball around the point P. So just look at a point P and look at these balls around point P. If you can bound the curvature in those balls, that's all you need. That translates into a lower bound for this ratio.
Sorry, but then with this parabolic rescaling or something, so he's showing that this redshift flow is then the Mighty fall in the sense that it's actually something that will never produce this.
Yeah. It will never produce worse singular behavior at the neck than a two sphere. So the neck cross section is just shrinking uniformly. It's not that one part of it shrinks more.
So it's basically proven that you can. That the original redshift flow is the correct tool to prove these things.
Yes.
You don't have to modify it or anything.
No, you don't have to do anything.
It will do the right job.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Okay. I mean, without his work, it was not at all clear. So this is the most important result, actually. So now the rest of it is really trivial because what you do is, so you achieved the fact that this cross section is a sphere by actually doing that Cheeger-Dromov convergence. And now what you do is you remove that two sphere, and so you have a two sphere, remove it, and then cap off with balls. And after you cap off, you can continue the Ricci flow on these smooth manifolds. And the statement, again, of Perelman is that if you continue this Ricci flow and if the initial entry, so if initial entry was simply connected then the only possibilities when you flow this is going to be S3 mod gamma or S2 cross S1 mod gamma for each of these pieces. And this was shown, this was proved by showing that these pieces disappear in finite time, and then these are the only possibilities. So I'm not going to do the proof of that because it's really too complicated. But you have these possibilities, and now the original manifold was simply connected. So what you can actually do is, again, now do a connected sum of these pieces and get back the original manifold. And that original manifold, since it was simply connected, had trivial fundamental group. Okay, but so each of these pieces also has to have a trivial fundamental group. So the only possibility is that you have S3. So this tells you that if you have a simply connected three-manifold, then it admits an S3 matrix, apart from removing these incompressible two schools.
But now, what about, what if you started with a manifold that had an incompressible T2?
Yeah, correct. So this part already proves the Poincaré conjecture, which is a part of the Thurston conjecture. Now, what happens when you have an incompressible T2? Now, that case is actually more complicated, and only recently, I believe, people have looked through Perelman's proof and they're convinced that that's also correct. So the idea again there has to do with the fact that suppose you have these incompressible two spheres, okay? Incompressible tori, then what will happen under the flow is that this thing is going to look flat, okay, because you have a torus cross-section instead of a sphere cross-section. Spheres shrink under this flow, tori don't, tori are like fixed points. So what's going to happen under this flow is that, well, if you have some here, it's going to get narrower and flat. So it's just getting pulled out. And what happens after a rescaling is that you can think of this M as M thick union M thin, where M thick is this big piece, or these big pieces, and M thin is that piece. Okay? And you can now do surgery, because what you're doing is you're removing these two tori, which you're allowed to do, and the metric is nearly flat out there, so you can remove it. And once you remove this, then this piece, we know how it flows. It flows to something of negative sectional curvature. Now this is enough to guarantee that it flows into one of the nice metrics. And this part, which is M thin, is something which is known as a Graaff manifold. And a Graaff manifold has a geometric decomposition. It's already known. Okay, so the case of when you have incompressible tori is also solved. It's also been solved. There were some minor issues with that, but I believe those are solved. Okay, so I could either do one proof of the monotonicity of the Ricci, or I could stop here. It's up to you. If you want to listen to that, then I can do that, or I can stop.
How long will it take?
It'll take about 10 minutes or 12 minutes. Should I do it? So I'm just going to do one of these proofs, which is actually the simplest proof that I can do on the board here. The others are pretty complicated, so just want to show you how the proof works. This proof tells you that Ricci flow is monotonic. And as I said, it is achieved by constructing an entropy. So how do you do that? Well, the starting point is this flow equation. Now, this is a flow for the metric, and this flow equation is not invariant under diffeomorphisms. Okay, if I change by a time-dependent diffeomorphism, that means at each point in time I change gauge in a different way, and the flow equation itself will change. So I'm going to call this flow equation as Ricci flow gauge. But suppose I do a time-dependent diffeomorphism, which I'm allowed to do because I'm only thinking of a flow-through geometries. So I do phi t star of g. Then what happens? Well, I can think of the generator of this diffeomorphism as being some xi, and the flow equation is now going to be modified. It's going to be d vi j tilde by dt, where j tilde is in the new coordinates. So you're going to get a new flow equation. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose this xi to be minus the gradient of the function. It's very similar to, you'll get something that's very similar to the RT flow of a metric with a dilaton and straight flow. So what you will get is that this looks like Rij plus rad I rad j. Since these two flows are related only by diffeomorphism, I'm allowed to do that, and I call this gauge P gauge. Now what I'm going to do is to put some restrictions on that function P. That is, I'm going to look at special diffeomorphisms such that that exponential minus p dv, the integral of that is 1 all along the flow. Okay? I'm going to choose such a p. Now the moment I say that this integral should be preserved along the flow, I know that the volume element is changing under the flow because it's changing according to this flow equation. So if I want this thing to be preserved, that means my p should obey a flow equation. Yeah, actually, these are in tilde coordinates, but I'm going to just forget about the tildes. Whenever I use this equation or I use this equation, I know they're related by change of gauge. So this forces P to have this flow equation. And notice that this is a backward heat flow. So the only way I can integrate this is backward time. Now I construct a functional, which is actually going to be my entropy. Construct this functional. Okay. Now it's fine to construct it, but how are we going to evaluate this functional at each point along the flow? So this is equal to f as a function of t. Okay, how am I going to evaluate this at each point of my flow? The reason I have a problem is because I have the metric and I have p in here, okay, and these two equations are coupled in this gauge. But I notice that this is diffeomorphism invariant, so I can do this in any gauge. Okay, I can evaluate this in any gauge. So how I'm going to do that, how I'm going to evaluate that, is that I'm going to go back to the Ricci flow gauge. In that gauge, the flow equation for P gets modified. Okay, I'm going to consider these two flow equations and I'm going to evaluate F. So the way I'm going to do that is I start from some initial t equal to 0, so t equal to t, and all along the way I compute the metric first. Okay, I integrate this equation and I get the metric from t equal to 0 to capital T. Now once I get the metric, I know what to put inside this Laplacian. And I can only integrate this equation in backward time because it's a backward heat flow. Okay? So Once I've gone up to the top, I know all the metrics from here to here. Now I integrate p backwards to get p. And at each point where I'm integrating p backwards, I also evaluate f, because f depends both on the metric and on p, and I need to do it this way. So f is evaluated backwards in time. Okay, that's the important point. So this is how you evaluate f, and you can also prove that f is monotonic under this flow. Df by dt is greater than or equal to c. And that's really easy to prove by just varying that function. Okay, but this does not solve my problem to have gotten an entropy like that. And this is the key part of Terman-Sharp. Well, if f depended only on geometry uniquely, okay, then what would happen? Then suppose I have a solution which is periodic in time, which is g of 0. Okay. So you have a periodic solution at t equal to 0 and at t equal to small t, you have the same geometry. Okay. Suppose I have a solution like that, and if f depended only on geometry, that would not be possible, unless f was constant all along from 0 to small t. Okay. So this thing would be ruled out if f depended only on geometry. But f does not depend only on geometry, that's the problem. It also depends on that function p. So I cannot say that such things are ruled out. So what is the trick? The trick is, this is r plus rand p squared exponential minus p dv. Just do an integration by parts, and it starts looking very interesting. If you do an integration by parts, you can write it like that, where the thing inside brackets is a Schrodinger operator. And remember that p also obeys a normalization condition, which is that exponential minus p dv is equal to, integral is equal to 1. So let me define exponential minus p by 2 to be some function u, and that normalization condition that we have there is the normalization condition u squared dv is 1. So this looks like a quantum mechanics problem, where u looks like a wave function, which is square integral. So u is an element of a square integral function. And this r looks like a potential. So we can actually stretch this, and we can choose u to be something really special. We can choose u to be an eigenfunction of the solver, and not just any eigenfunction, because u is an exponential of something, so u is always positive. So the only eigenfunction that we know for sure is positive in a Schrodinger problem is the lowest eigenfunction, because it has no norms. Okay? So we choose u to be the lowest eigenfunction of the operator minus the plus u plus r. And if you do that, then what do you get for this functional f? This functional f is just u times lambda u dv, which is just lambda, because u squared integral over dv is 1. So with that choice of u, f becomes that. And this choice of u minimizes f, because the minimum value that you can have is the lowest eigenfunction over the space of all choices of u which are square integral. Okay. So this is the minimum over all u which are square integrable of f. So now I have to do one more thing. So I should mention here that I can choose this u to be the lowest eigenfunction only at one time. I'm not guaranteed that if I start flowing the u under this whatever flowing equation is supposed to satisfy, I'm not guaranteed that it remains the lowest eigenfunction. Okay? So I can choose this at one time, and what I'm going to choose is I'm going to say that from t is equal to 0 to t equal to t, I evaluate f backwards, remember? So I'm going to choose that at this time, f at t is equal to t is the same as the lowest eigenfunction. So I can guarantee that at any one point, but I cannot guarantee that along the flow it remains the lowest eigenfunction. Now f is monotonic, so we derive, or we said that df by dt is greater than or equal to 0. So what does the monotonicity of f mean for two different times? It tells you that f at t equal to t is greater than or equal to f at t less than t. That's the monotonicity. Now at capital T, I'm going to choose f to be the same as the lowest eigenfunction. So this thing, I'm going to choose to be the same as lambda at capital T. So lambda at capital T is greater than or equal to f at small t, but f is always bigger than or equal to lambda at the same time, because lambda minimizes f. So this is greater than or equal to lambda small t. So this tells me that lambda at capital T is always less greater than or equal to lambda at small t. So lambda is monotonic. So the lowest eigenvalue of the Schrodinger operator on this manifold N is monotonic.
So can you repeat again where can you choose capital T, the minimum value, the particular value of lambda, f at capital T equal to lambda? Can you say it
wrong? I'm sorry?
Yeah.
At capital T, I'm choosing f to be the same as lambda. That's an initial condition.
That you are always able to do
that. No, I can always do that. That's just an initial condition for the differential equation for u. I'm choosing u to be the lowest eigenfunction at some starting time. I can always do that. Okay, and then when I flow, it need not remain the lowest eigenfunction, but it doesn't matter because it's monotonic. I just proved that it's monotonic. So lambda is monotonic. But lambda is really nice, because it depends only on the geometry. It's the lowest eigenvalue of this operator minus Laplacian plus R. And because it depends only on the geometry, it rules out periodic solutions. So this is the periodicity result of Kelvin. So I'll stop.
Tomorrow,
sure.
More about.